Welcome to SCOTUS Cast, Judicial Campaigns Solicitations Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On January 20th, 2015, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Williams-Yulee v. the Florida Bar. This case asks whether Florida's rule of judicial conduct that prohibits candidates for judicial office from personally soliciting campaign funds violates the First Amendment. In an opinion delivered by Chief Justice Roberts, the court held by a vote of 5-4 that Florida's rule does not violate the First Amendment. The judgment of the Supreme Court of Florida was affirmed. Justices Breyer, Sotomayor, and Kagan joined the Chief Justice's opinion in full, and Justice Ginsburg joined all except Part 2. Justice Breyer filed a concurring opinion. Justice Ginsburg filed an opinion concurring in part and concurring in the judgment, which Justice Breyer joined as Part 2. Justice Scalia filed a dissenting opinion, which Justice Thomas joined. Justices Kennedy and Alito also filed dissenting opinions. To discuss the case, we have Professor Brian T. Fitzpatrick, a professor of law at Vanderbilt University School of Law, as well as Eric Jaffe, who is a sole practitioner at Eric S. Jaffe, PC. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Fitzpatrick.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here to talk about this case. This is the second case that the U.S. Supreme Court has decided in recent years about judicial free speech rights. And the first case the Supreme Court decided in this area was many years ago now, it was in 2002, when I was a law clerk to Justice Scalia, who wrote that 2002 opinion. It was Republican Party of Minnesota v. White. And in that case, the Supreme Court struck down another one of these ABA-inspired restrictions on the ability of judges and candidates who are running for election to speak. The court struck it down 5-4. It was along partisan lines. And the Republican Party of Minnesota v. White decision spawned, over a decade now of litigation in the various states that have judicial elections against other ABA-inspired restrictions on the ability of these judges and these candidates when they're running for election to speak. And so we have come back to the Supreme Court now with a canon from the state of Florida. And so Florida elects its trial judges. Florida has a different system for its appellate judges. Florida depends upon something called the Missouri Plan or merit selection for its appellate judges, where a commission heavily influenced by the bar nominates judges to the governor, and the governor picks one of those people for the appellate courts. For the trial courts, they have good old-fashioned elections, and in Florida there is still a ABA-inspired canon on the books, canon of judicial ethics, that prohibits judges who are running for those trial court elections, prohibits them from personally soliciting money for their election. So they have to run an election, but they cannot personally solicit money for their campaign. They're allowed to solicit money through a campaign committee, and they are allowed to know who gives them money because they're allowed to write thank you notes to the people that gave them money, but they cannot solicit the money. And in this case, a lawyer that was running for the trial bench for one of the county courts in Florida wrote a letter, kind of an open letter, and sent it out to a bunch of people and put it on the internet. And the letter said, why this lawyer was qualified to be a judge. And the letter said, please give me a little bit of money to start my campaign. And the bar came down on this candidate for personally soliciting money in her campaign for the trial bench. And so the question then was litigated on whether this restriction on personally soliciting money violates the United States Constitution, in particular, whether it violates the First Amendment, whether people running for judicial office have a right to personally solicit money. The Florida Supreme Court said that the canon, you know, they promulgate the canons. They said the canon was constitutional, and the United States Supreme Court decided to review it. And I think in something of a surprise, the court ruled 5-4 that this canon was constitutional. It was okay to prohibit candidates for the trial bench from personally soliciting money. Chief Justice Roberts wrote the opinion, and he was joined by the four more liberal justices. And the principal dissent was written by Justice Scalia, but there was some shorter dissents written by Justice Kennedy and Justice Alito as well. So 5-4 with the chief flipping, if you will, to the more liberal side, and really flipping from the partisan divide on this issue that I think was created in the Republican Party Minnesota v. White decision in 2002. And so just, you know, to go through the three questions the court had to answer in this case. Number one was the question of what is the standard by which the court is going to review this particular restriction on judicial speech? Is it going to be strict scrutiny or something less than that? And honestly, I thought this was kind of a difficult question based on the precedent coming into this case. On the one hand, this is a content-based restriction. You know, if the person talks about money, then the person's prohibited from speaking. If they talk about other things, they're not. So it's a content-based restriction. Those normally get strict scrutiny. In Republican Party Minnesota v. White in 2002, the canon there prevented judges from announcing their views on issues that might come before them on the bench later on if they were to get onto the bench. And everyone in that case assumed strict scrutiny applied. And so there was certainly some reasons to think that strict scrutiny would apply here as well. On the other hand, you know, this is a content-based restriction on speech, but it's content-based about money. And there are some cases out there that when it comes to money speech, we have a more permissive regime. And you know, there are some of these campaign finance decisions which don't apply strict scrutiny. And there are, of course, all the commercial speech cases where, you know, people are making commercial solicitations for money, and those do not get strict scrutiny either. So could have gone either way. But 8-1. 8-1, the Supreme Court rules that strict scrutiny is required. The only dissenting vote on that, I believe, was Justice Ginsburg. So we're in strict scrutiny land. But the Chief Justice said, in his opinion for the court, that this is the rare restriction that satisfies strict scrutiny. So the second question in the case was, what is the compelling interest here? And the Chief Justice said that the compelling interest to support this prohibition on solicitation of money was the integrity of the courts, or sometimes he phrased it as public confidence in the impartiality of the courts. And he was not very analytical or very precise about what exactly he meant by integrity or public confidence in the impartiality of the courts. And Justice Scalia really calls him out on this. He just really rests on some very vague kind of platitude-esque compelling interests here. And Scalia really goes after him there. In Republican Party Minnesota v. White, Justice Scalia really tried to do a very rigorous analysis of this impartiality, compelling interest, and he divided it into all kinds of categories of what impartiality could mean. Here, the Chief Justice said, it's hard to define this stuff, but of course it's important. Integrity, impartiality are hard to define, the Chief Justice says, but who could deny that they're compelling? So once the court gets past the compelling interest, and there's the question of whether the restriction here is narrowly tailored. And here, the court, Chief Justice Roberts, does two things that Justice Scalia really, I think, gets a lot of traction in criticizing in his dissent. Number one, the Chief Justice requires absolutely no evidence that this particular restriction will sap public confidence in the courts, for example. There's really no empirical evidence given. There's really not even any anecdotal evidence that's given. It's really based on common sense. The Chief Justice thinks common sense suggests that these things will sap public confidence and impartiality and integrity. And that seems to be enough. Now, you know, that's often not enough in strict scrutiny land. usually we do require a little more seriousness, a little more rigor in the evidentiary basis. I remember there was a case not too long ago about violent video games out of California, and there were actually some studies that showed that, you know, violence in video games led to various problems or conditions if young people got those video games. And I remember the court said in its opinion, you know, these studies that are cited to us, they're not very good studies because they haven't controlled for other relevant variables. They're not, you know, the regression analysis wasn't good enough. And so that wasn't good enough for compelling interest or narrow tailoring, at least in the video game case. But here we didn't have anything like that, and it was good enough. So one question here is, have we watered down strict scrutiny a little bit with the Chief Justice's analysis? The other part of the narrow tailoring inquiry goes into whether the restriction here is over-inclusive or under-inclusive. And the Chief Justice was fairly dismissive of the arguments that there was under- or over-inclusiveness here, not because he didn't think there wasn't over-under-inclusiveness, but he basically said, you know, we don't require the states to tackle all the problems at the same time. And so he just really was not very serious, I didn't think, about inquiring into over and under inclusiveness. So, for example, this canon prohibits judges from soliciting any contributions from anyone, including the judges or the candidate's parents, even people that could never appear before the court because they live in other states or for whatever reason could never appear before this court. The canon still applies to those people. And Scalia says there's absolutely no reason to think that public confidence and impartiality or integrity would be threatened by asking people for money who can never be a party in a case before the judge. But the Chief Justice did not seem concerned about that. And so, you know, I think one aspect of this case presents some interesting and resolves some interesting First Amendment questions. Like I've said, strict scrutiny applying to the speech, how the strict scrutiny was applied. This is an interesting decision from a First Amendment perspective, and I think Eric will probably talk more about that when he has his chance to comment. But what I would like to say about the decision is not so much what it means as a First Amendment case, but what it means as a judicial selection case, because the undercurrent of this case was the same undercurrent we had in Republican Party Minnesota v. White, which is, how should we select judges? That's a question that is underneath the surface of this case, and it was before, and I'll tell you why. These canons that these states have, they come from the ABA again, and the ABA hates judicial elections. The ABA has been against judicial elections for a very long time. The ABA prefers what Florida does for its appellate courts, this Missouri plan or merit selection plan. Justice Scalia notes this in his dissent. He says, what a surprise, the ABA prefers this commission system because the commissions that nominate the judges to the governor are full of lawyers. They're lawyers' commissions. They're commissions often selected by the bar. And so the ABA prefers basically the bar picking the judges, and the ABA does not like judicial elections. And the ABA cannot stop the states from adopting elections because their elections are very popular. So what the ABA does instead is the ABA promulgates these speech restrictions that prohibit the elections from being very meaningful. They have really tried to do everything they can to take the wind out of the sails of the people that are running for judicial office to make the elections as meaningless as possible. And, you know, when the U.S. Supreme Court in Minnesota v. White said we're not going to let the ABA do that, the court basically had to make a decision. And the decision was, do we think judicial elections are an okay way to select judges? And I'll tell you, the dissent in that case was written by Justice Ginsburg. And the essence of her dissent was she thought the judicial elections violated the Due Process Clause. She thought that if you had a case in front of a judge that was elected, it violated due process. You were not getting a independent and impartial judge by definition. That was her view. And the Supreme Court, the majority, rejected that view and said judicial elections are just fine. And the reason why the court took that view in Republican Party Minnesota v. White was because there was a disagreement that was aired about how judges make their decisions. Are they made in the realist conception of the judge, or are they made in the kind of pre-realist conception of the judge? And what do I mean by that? Well, you know, for a very long time, and some people still believe, that judges apply the law in a very neutral way, that their own personal views do not influence their decisions. This, you know, used to be how we thought about judges until the movement in the early 1900s, the realist movement, made the case that, in fact, there's a lot of ambiguity in how judges do their work, and a lot of times that ambiguity is filled with the judge's personal views, for better or for worse. The judge's personal views about what is good and bad, what's good policy and bad, influences their decisions. That's especially the case if the judge is not going to be an originalist or a textualist. There's even more room for the judge's personal opinions to influence the judge's opinions. Well, if you believe in this realist view of the judge, that the judge's personal opinions will influence their decisions from the bench, then you can certainly understand why states would want to elect their judges. Judges are basically acting as lawmakers or policymakers to some extent. In a lot of states, of course, you have common law powers of the state judiciary as well. That's explicitly a lawmaking role, at least today as we understand what the common law is. And if you believe this about judges, then it makes perfect sense that you would want to elect judges. They're basically lawmakers or policymakers, so they should be accountable to the public. And that's the view that Justice Scalia put forth in his opinion in Republican Party Minnesota v. White. And Justice Ginsburg put forth the opposite view, that no, judges were different. And because judges were different, they were not supposed to be held accountable to anyone because they were making decisions based on the law, not on their policy preferences. So that view didn't carry the day in Republican Party Minnesota v. White, but one implication of today, or of this new decision, is whether the Ginsburg view now holds majority sway on the Supreme Court, that maybe Chief Justice Roberts wishes to endorse the Ginsburg view of it's the law and not the policy preferences of the judge that is doing the work in our judiciary. And if he does want to associate himself with that side of the question, then I think it does raise an issue about what kind of commitment the Supreme Court will have to facilitating judicial elections in future cases. There's a lot of canons the ABA has to try to diminish judicial elections, and it looked like for a while the lower courts were going to strike them all down because of Republican Party v. Minnesota, but now the Chief Justice has switched sides, so to speak. It's not clear to me what kind of commitment the U.S. Supreme Court has to facilitating judicial elections anymore. And so I think that is an important development out of this case. It does call into some question about how robust judicial elections will be able to be in the future. With that, I think I'll turn it over to Eric.
Great. I agree with so much of what was just said about this, and Professor Fitzpatrick is right that I will make some comments on the how strict scrutiny was treated here. I'm not surprised that three of the four liberal justices went along with Chief Justice Roberts in saying strict scrutiny applies, because the game here is to kill strict scrutiny, not to refuse to apply it, but to water it down to a point where it's meaningless. And I think that's what we saw, that in order to get the ruling that strict scrutiny applied, Roberts was willing to make a mockery of it. And the other three liberal judges who joined him said, great, if that's what strict scrutiny means, we're on board. And lo and behold, look at Justice Breyer's concurrence that says, well, with the understanding that the two tiers are really meaningless and we can do whatever we want, I agree. So there's no surprise to me at all that they signed on for that. Justice Ginsburg is a little bit more of a stickler for the rules, and consequently, it's equally no surprise that she declined to join that little game. And I think Scalia is spot on. If this is what you call strict scrutiny, you're just sort of spitting in the eye of strict scrutiny. This is not strict scrutiny. It's not close to strict scrutiny. It's a result-oriented answer. It reminds me in so many ways of the rational basis scrutiny that gets applied in certain cases that looks awfully like intermediate scrutiny in some cases. And I'll let all the listeners figure out which those cases are. I'm sure they're well aware of them. And so that I found disappointing about this, that, look, if you want to say it's not going to be strict scrutiny because this speech is different, go ahead. I think that would be the wrong answer, but at least it would be candid. If you're going to say this is strict scrutiny because it's such wonderfully important speech, but it's okay to restrict it on a not terribly well-tailored rule that has no support for the actual injuries involved, well, you know, come on, that's not judging, that's results with a fake answer attached to it, which is pretty much what Scalia said. And I think he's right on the money on that. The second thing that struck me about this and about the comments that we just heard about what does this mean in terms of our view of the role and the procedure of judging, you know, is it the law or is it preferences? What always frusts me about these cases is that they arise inevitably out of the state courts, which are, of course, the only places you could have judicial elections, and no one bothers to wonder what it is about state court judges that somehow might be different and justify having elections in the first place. And the answer seems self-evident. The answer is that, of course, the answer is that they get to make policy. That's what they actually do. While federal court judges don't get to make the law, state court judges do. They routinely make the law in the context of common law, is the easiest instance of that, where their policy preferences, their judgments, their values indeed play a role in the making of the law, and not an illegitimate role like the critical legal studies folks would have you believe, but a perfectly valid role because that's how state judges are different. Well, given that, it's no surprise that we then want to elect them, because if they're going to be legislating, making judicial rules, then we want to have some say in the values and the views of those who legislate from the bench, legitimately legislate from the bench. While I agree with the Chief Justice and the majority that in other cases, judges have to apply the facts and the existing law and any binding precedent in a neutral way, That is not all that they do. They are very much unlike federal judges in that sense. And so to apply the federal judge model of the neutral umpire who only applies the law and has no personal views at all about anything is false as to this category of judges. So the hostility that you see coming from the four more liberal justices and now potentially from Chief Justice Roberts toward judicial elections, I think just doesn't take into account or doesn't weight in any meaningful way the differences between federal and state judges. So that's something that I found disappointing, that there was no acknowledgement of why you might want to elect them and therefore why they indeed might be very much like politicians in some senses, even if not in every sense. Instead, the chief just sort of says, well, they're nothing at all like politicians. It's completely different. We don't have to treat them like politicians, and we expect more. The third thing that struck me, and I think also struck Professor Fitzpatrick, is that not merely the lack of evidence for the supposedly compelling interest, but really the definition of the sort of the core interest that he seemed to focus on. Scalia, I think, is correct that the interest he relies on switches back and forth at his convenience. But at the end of the day, if you're being fair about it, the interest that he's articulating is an interest in the appearance of judicial integrity, so public confidence in the integrity of the judiciary, which is very different than the actual integrity of the judiciary. It's okay if they lack actual integrity, as long as the public doesn't see it. And I think you see that fact most clearly in his attempt to distinguish thank you notes and committee solicitations from personal solicitations. So the judge can have his number two, his campaign chair, solicit on his behalf with his full knowledge of people that he's given a list for. The judge can then thank the, you know, find out what the result of that solicitation was and send thank you notes and keep a little checklist of who said no. And he can lack integrity in every conceivable way possible and actually take it out on those people. But since nobody knows, it's okay. That's the gist of what this says. Since no one knows, you don't have to worry about that. Even though it poses an identical risk of judicial bias, it's just less visible. I actually think that that interest is invalid. It is not merely not enough. I think it is antithetical to the First Amendment. It's functionally an interest in misleading the public. We're not worried about whether there's genuine judicial bias. We're just worried about whether they see it. And so if we can keep it from their view whatever's really going on behind the curtain is okay. That can't be a sensible way to structure campaign finance restrictions. And you see the same issue cropping up in normal campaign finance cases too, not just judicial cases, that the appearance of corruption is now the big interest that we rely on because we can never prove actual risk of corruption in most of these cases because of campaign contribution caps and things like that. So it's always the appearance that gets relied upon. And so I find that disappointing that that has become the primary compelling interest upon which all future restrictions will depend. One can imagine that if that is genuinely compelling, we should not publicize any kind of judicial discipline that shows a corrupt judge, that we should keep that private, completely private, because that would serve that interest perfectly. It's probably the least restrictive way to do it. And as long as you actually punish the judge and try to solve their actual corruption, as long as not letting anyone know about it is the best answer. And you know, anyone listening to that theory presumably is as repulsed by that notion as I am. So overall, I was disappointed that the chief switched over. I wasn't surprised that the four went the way they went. I think that was inevitable given Republican Party versus White. And, you know, it's a little odd that the chief bails out, given that he's usually pretty good on the normal campaign finance. And I think the answer has to be the one suggested that that Scalia suggested, at least, that this is about us, the Brotherhood of the Robe, and there's just a certain greater level of personal offense and, you know, the assumption that we know what really goes on. It's almost like judicial fact-finding. Who needs thinking legislative fact-finding when we have our own smart brains clad in robes to tell us what's really going on? And it had that smell to it, which I think is effectively what Justice Scalia deridingly described.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.